Case number 13-7077, Darlene T. Robinson, Appellant v. Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, et al. Mr. Parsons for the appellant, Ms. Carey for the appellees.
Your Honor, please, my name is Charles Parsons. I represent the appellant, Darlene Robinson. In June of 2012, evidence was presented in a jury trial, and the jury found that a bus operator was negligent, caused the destabilization of one of his standing passengers, who fell and suffered injury, and they awarded damages accordingly. They found that the passenger was not contributory negligent. In that trial, we submitted what we contend to be three bases for this jury verdict, and I'll break those bases out under the names of the case law that support them. First of all, I would like to start with the O'Neill versus WMATA case. This was a case that was cited by Judge Huvel in denying defendant's motion for summary judgment before the trial ever started. This particular case was totally omitted in Judge Friedman's order entering JNOV. O'Neill establishes a duty. When a passenger gets on a bus, a passenger common carrier relationship is created. The carrier then owes that passenger a duty to prevent or protect them from foreseeable harm. And they have a duty to protect the passenger's peaceful completion of their journey. Also received in evidence were any number of WMATA standards.
And did you establish a national standard in the way that Judge Friedman discussed?
And we feel that we did. And
now
Judge,
don't tell me about feelings. Tell me if you did or not.
We did.
Tell me where
you did. And let me tell you why. I'll tell you why we did.
Okay, show me where you did.
All right. First of all, if you look, let's just go to. If you look, what do we say was the national standard of care? In the report by Dr. Berkowitz, which is in the appendix.
I'm sorry to interrupt just for one second. Was the report itself in evidence? Was it an exhibit at the trial?
The report itself was not in evidence.
So for our purposes, it's relevant to summary judgment, but it's not relevant to decision to reverse the trial verdict, is it?
Well, let's put it this way. Certainly, the basis for his opinions, he spelled out in some detail.
You need what's in the record. Yeah.
Okay.
So everything he said in his testimony is fair game, but the exhibit, that is the exhibit you're about to point us to, that wasn't actually in the trial record, so it's not really something we can look at for purposes of reversing Judge Friedman, is it?
In other words, what you're saying is that what should have been offered were the research studies that he relied upon.
We're not saying anything. We're asking you to show us where in the record you have established a national standard.
So I'm not saying you should have. I'm just asking, shouldn't we be restricted to looking at what he testified to, which includes his reference to these various standards, but not the report itself?
I agree that the report was not in evidence. However, he made reference to the APTA studies, right, the National Science Studies, the Department of Transportation studies, all of which were intended to prevent onboard passenger injuries, and came up with formulated steps which he testified were contained in the WMATA standard operating procedures and rules and regulations were derived from those very studies, and that they were intended, that the studies were intended to identify what were the recurring instances of onboard passenger destabilization and falls, and also how you prevent them. Then he testified that what WMATA had, and he went specifically to, I think it's the exhibit 46 and 48 in the exhibits that were received in evidence. Specifically, under the national standard of care, a bus operator should check to make sure his passengers are prepared for movement before leaving.
Those exhibits, those are the SOPs of WMATA? Is that your...
That's correct. Derived from the studies of APTA, Department of Transportation, National Academy of Sciences. All of these intended to prevent. And in fact, the WMATA standards even go so far as to say that our standards are based upon extensive research and studies and experience. What Dr. Berkowitz was doing was providing just basically because of his involvement with these different governmental agencies and his long standing as a transportation engineer, was essentially explaining how they came to be and how the WMATA standards were derived from these various studies. He testified that, indeed, the WMATA standards comported with the national standard of care as derived from these studies by the various governmental agencies.
The studies themselves, were they for the establishment of national
standards? I'm sorry.
The studies themselves, were they establishing national standards, or were they aspirational?
What you would do is you would get together the various transit authorities around the country, and they would sit down and research what are the recurring instances of onboard passenger injuries. And then can we come up with some concrete procedures and policies to try to avoid these from recurring? Can we then formulate them in written rules? And if we formulate them in written rules, by consensus, can we have various transportation agencies adopt them? And then, of course, it was those very rules that WMATA in their own regs, and I think
can
I...
Can you tell me briefly what the national standard of care is that you established and where you how you established that it was violated by WMATA in this case?
Okay. Basically, let me just cite you to... I will see if I can refer directly to the... Exhibit number 57... it's at Appendix 937. It says the operator must check the mirrors before leaving the stop to assure the passenger is prepared for movement. Then again, under Exhibit 62 at the appendix, and by the way, that's also at Exhibit 61, Appendix 941.
Yeah, again, to be clear, that's the WMATA standard of SOP,
that's the,
right?
That's the standard that WMATA has put in place and has taken all discretion away from its bus operators.
Well, that's a different question. I think the question Judge Santel is asking you, what's the evidence that this standard is the national standard? Where would we find that?
From Dr. Berkowitz's testimony.
And did he specifically testify that this standard was the standard?
He did, yes, Your Honor. Uh-huh. He said, let me just see if I can... He explained that the WMATA SOPs and rules and regulations were derived from these studies and comported with the national standard of care. But that's not even really in dispute, because WMATA's own safety directives confirm that these regulations that they require their bus operators to follow are based on extensive research and experience. WMATA was part of the meetings and the gatherings of the transit authorities that Dr. Berkowitz attended. And they were there debating these very standards. And then when he looked at what they had compiled, it was very clear that based on their extensive research and experience, they had adopted the standards from these particular studies.
Do you agree for purposes of the appeal that you did have to establish these are national standards?
I don't. I think we went above and beyond what was required. If we look at O'Neill, we basically have regulations that are in place. They're published standards, and they take away all discretion from the bus operators. They have to follow these standards. Under O'Neill, the fact that the bus operator must follow sets a reasonable and appropriate. That's what the case says.
But the D.C. cases say that while you can rely on the standards, they're not dispositive. You have to have additional evidence, right? There's some evidence of negligence, but not all evidence.
I would submit that under O'Neill, I believe under Young, that there, where the – it is quite true that there will be times where you have regulations, and if there's discretion accorded to the person who's –
Well, Young says WMATA's SOP, while not conclusive of the question, was some evidence of the degree of care required. And it also says, although company rules are not conclusive or wholly definitive, and the violation does not constitute negligence per se, we hold that they constitute some indication of the care required. I'm not saying this hurts you.
Let me follow up on that point.
You're not taking the position that the SOPs alone are sufficient.
No, I'm saying that prima facie case, question of fact. And under O'Neill, since you page 841, they say the WMATA standard operating procedures and rules are evidence of a reasonable standard of care and one from which the operator must comply. Furthermore, these standards under O'Neill say that they are within the ken of the ordinary person and require no expert testimony. In a sense, you could say that Dr. Berkowitz was overkill.
There was a jury instruction that says you can only determine the standard of care required of WMATA from the testimony of expert witnesses.
That was Judge Friedman's testimony. That's the way it went down at trial, but I can tell you.
Did you all object to that instruction?
I'm sorry?
Did you object to that instruction?
I don't recall that I preserved my objection on that. I would say this, though, that nevertheless, Judge Friedman never addressed O'Neill in his JNOV opinion.
On the part of your argument where you say that you can establish a standard without expert testimony.
Under O'Neill, yes, sir.
Under O'Neill, how can we sustain the verdict based on that argument, given that the jury was instructed that it had to rely on expert testimony and there was no objection made to that?
Well, I will concede that that is a problem, all right? But no trial is perfect. I would only say, though, that if you simply apply the law, that certainly this was one of those cases where the regs were in front of the jury, the subject matter of the regs.
It's not just a question of us applying the law, because all we can look at is what the jury found. And the jury couldn't have adopted an O'Neill theory by which it found a standard divorced from expert testimony, because it was instructed that it could only find a standard of care based on expert testimony.
So maybe I've overstated it when I say it was overkill. We established it three different ways, in my view. Certainly Dr. Berkowitz, having worked in this particular area and worked with WMATA in this area, and knowing the national standard of care, knowing the intent of why these regulations were formulated, and knowing that the WMATA regulations that were in place and required bus operators to follow was, in fact, what the national standard of care was. It's a reasonable standard of care. It was deviated from rather clearly by the testimony of the bus operator.
Now, I'm not quite – I'd hate to be too belaboring on this, but I'm not quite certain yet what you say the national standard of care is that you established the violation of.
If the studies come up with –
Never mind the if or where they came from. Tell me what the standard is that you say you established, and tell me how you established it was violated.
Through expert testimony of Dr. Berkowitz, we established that a bus operator leaving a bus stop must first assure that his vulnerable standing passengers are prepared for movement. There's an outright admission by WMATA, even a stipulation, that Mr. Bumpus did not know, and yet nevertheless started off.
So the standard is the WMATA rule that you pointed us to that says you're supposed to look in the rearview mirror?
That's
Is that the standard you're relying on?
It's a combination. There's a standard that says that the mirror must be adjusted so that you could see everything, and then under, I think it's standard where, just so I can.
You're looking at JA-41, I take it, after completing.
It's like 941 in the appendix. 941 and then also 942. Exhibit 61, the key verb is check. Check before leaving the stop to assure that passenger is prepared for movement. And both Dr. Berkowitz and the bus director, Mr. Harris, testified that that means use the mirror. The mirror is a safety device. Look in the mirror before you move the bus, before you release your brakes to move away from the bus stop.
So,
check to make.
So in this case, if the driver looks in the mirror, what does the driver see?
If the driver had complied with the standard, the driver would see that Ms. Robinson, with her back to him, was still standing and was looking for a seat.
But still standing is fine. The jury instructions themselves say it. That you can't predicate liability on the fact that she was standing, as I recall. So it can't be the fact that she's standing, because standing, there's nothing necessarily insecure about standing.
Not necessarily, you're right, but you need to know if they are prepared for movement.
And she's holding, as to that, he looks in the mirror, and what he sees is that she's grabbing the rail behind the seat.
The bar on the back of the seat.
Right.
So to that extent, she was looking at it, but... The point is, without looking, you can't know if that were the case.
But what I'm saying is, if he did look, what he would have seen is. So I take your point. Let's just hypothesize that there's a standard that requires you to look. Then you still have to establish causation, which shows that the failure to look caused an injury. And what I'm asking you is, suppose there is a standard that says you have to look. If he did look, what he sees is someone who's standing up and holding the handle.
Okay. He would not have seen a lady prepared for movement in this respect. There are vertical poles that you can really brace yourself, but with her back to him, unaware that he's going to pull off quickly, sure, she's holding a handrail. People are supposed to do that, but that doesn't automatically convey to the operator, now I can dart off. Because the next step was that he violated the next standard, which is 62. He did not start slowly.
Can you over the one that Judge Srinivasan is asking you about? Before you get to the start slowly, this is a separate standard. With respect to the standard that requires him to look to see if passenger is secured, if we take your client's testimony that she was holding on, pretty tightly. Was there any testimony by the plaintiff's expert that holding on isn't enough to be prepared, that you need to be holding this vertical pole that you're talking about?
I know I'm pouring into the next standard, but what he basically said is when you look, you have to be aware that when you pull off, there's a jerk rate, and it doesn't necessarily follow that.
Can I interrupt you for one second?
Yes, sir.
I understood you had separate standards, each of which you said was violated. I just want to focus on the first one, which I think is maybe the most important one, which is you got to look in your mirror and see if people are prepared. Now, if he had looked, as Judge Srinivasan points out, he would have seen that she was holding on. Is there some national standard that the expert testified to that holding on isn't good enough, that the bus driver has to see more than holding on?
Okay. I would just say that Dr. Berkowitz said that from the committee meetings and the standards committees that he attended, that most of the time when you see that you've got a standing passenger with your back to the driver, that you alert them, I'm getting ready to move. Now, that was something that took, the whole object is to not destabilize them. The standards should be read in the context of trying to provide safe transportation for these passengers. Here, had the operator looked, he would have seen a lady with his back to him and her hand on it. Having your back to the operator is no suggestion, I would submit, that they're prepared for movement. They're not aware that they're going to move. Checking to see if they're ready for movement means that you really literally do check, and you do establish an objective basis for knowing that that movement could be made in safety.
I'm missing something basic here, maybe, but at first I thought, right, if at least there's something to the notion that if she's not looking forward, there may be a reason to think she's not prepared. But even if she's looking forward, how does she know that the bus is going to move?
Who's in control? It's the bus. Who's responsible? Is she responsible for anticipating the bus operator?
No, but my point is
the training that he gets as a bus operator one that he's supposed to be looking out for the protection of this passenger and making sure, is she ready or not?
Well, maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying. I thought what you were saying is the fact that she was facing backwards should be a clue to the bus driver that he shouldn't yet move.
Correct.
Let's just hypothesize that I'm in agreement with you. If she were turning around and looking at the front, towards the front instead, why is she any more aware that he's about to hit the accelerator? She's not looking at his foot pedal. She's just looking. I guess I'm not understanding why it is that facing backwards necessarily means.
It's through whose eyes you're looking at this. Are you supposed to be looking at through the eyes of the plaintiff, or are you supposed to be looking through the eyes of the trained operator who's supposed to be ascertaining for a fact that before he moves his bus and releases his brakes and moves his bus, that he's got people he's not going to destabilize? I'm viewing it through the eyes.
I'm viewing it through his eyes, and maybe there's just something obvious I'm missing, but I'm viewing it through the driver's eyes, and what I'm asking is, when you're a driver, when you see somebody that's facing in the opposite direction, just the fact that they're facing in the opposite direction, why does that tell you that they're not prepared for you to move? Whereas if they're facing the front direction, they still don't know when you're going to move.
It leaves you in the position where you don't know. And the object of these standards, as I read, check to make sure that they're ready for movement, it means more than just a glance and then go. It means ascertaining whether you can, with certainty and safety, pull away from that bus stop.
Does that mean announcing you're about to start?
That's a debated point, but I'm going to state that no, it does not necessarily require that. The object is not to destabilize them. What steps an operator conscientiously trying to keep his vulnerable standing passenger from being thrown to the floor under the circumstances? The object is check to make sure they're ready for movement. I'm not if they're check could very well mean. If their back's to you and you're not sure, you should warn them. I'm not sure how expansive the verb check is, but it certainly was enough, in my view, to have gone to the jury on that question.
Your other standard, which is to start slowly and smoothly?
Yes, sir.
So Judge Friedman said that was superseded by D.C. law, which is another one of your theories, which is extraordinary force out of the ordinary, usual operation of a bus. That the D.C. cases say that a common carrier, and I'm reading now from the jury instruction that you got, is not liable for sudden starts, stops, jerks, or jars, which are no more than necessary or usual incidents of the operation. So isn't that, I'm not saying you don't have a theory about the sudden jerk, but it seems like whatever theory you have has to rest on D.C. law and not on this SOP.
Okay, so when you get into this question of what constitutes a jerk that is out of the ordinary or inconsistent with the proper operation of the vehicle, what you basically have is Judge Friedman never considered the aerial photograph that was presented that showed he's focused on the adjectives that she used and not superimposing those adjectives onto the actual linear path the bus followed and the short time that it did it, coupled with the intermittent movement, braking and jerks that she described as it went through this short path. He pulled off from it suddenly. She's standing there. He braked a couple of times. He's jerking, sufficiently to jerk her hand off that handrail, throw her to the floor, and fracture her ankle. I mean, that is not consistent, I would submit. He's looking at the adjectives and saying, well, you know, fast, that's relative. But when you look at it in the context of an aerial where Mr. Bumpus actually showed on the aerial the distance that he traveled, The stops that he had to make, he claimed to a complete stop. She said he jerked several times but didn't come to a full stop until she'd been thrown to the floor. I mean, I respectfully submit that this is not consistent with proper bus operation, and the severity of the injury tends to bear that out under the Boyko case.
If I could prolong it just a little bit longer, O'Neill is a case of principal reliance. Does the Malone decision at all limit the presidential force of O'Neill?
I think not. I think that there's enough other cases that, I guess it's never what the Court of Appeals said last time. It's what they'll say this time. Malone, I submit, does not alter that the underlying vigor of the position in O'Neill under Young or under the Pasmino case. The whole object of it is to make sure that passengers are safely transported, whether you're and in this case, I just submit that they were not.
Okay, thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Kathleen Carey on behalf of the WMATA. I think, first of all, I'd like to address some of the questions that the panel has asked Mr. Parsons regarding identification of the standard of care that he alleges that his expert established in the trial. His inability to do that, even here before Your Honors in an oral argument, I think underscores the weakness of Dr. Berkowitz's testimony that we heard in the trial. Dr. Berkowitz uses the words such as emanate from and filter down when he describes what the standards are that he says were created by a variety of different studies and research conducted over the years. And it's exactly this type of incredibly vague and nonspecific testimony that the court, both this court and the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, have criticized when reviewing the competence and the sufficiency of testimony by an expert in establishing the standard of care.
Step one back on the look in your mirror to see if your passengers are prepared. Why is an expert required for that? Why is that beyond the ken of an ordinary juror, that a reasonable thing to do before you start driving is to look and make sure people are prepared? Now, I'll take, for purposes of this question, let's use prepared meaning having your hand holding onto something. So I'll give you that part of it.
Okay.
But assuming she didn't have her hand holding onto something and she was balanced on one foot, wouldn't an ordinary juror be able to say that it's negligent to not look in your mirror and check before you start?
Actually, no, because, and I would refer the court to the testimony of our expert, Mr. Edward Harris, who testified with respect to the experience and the training that bus operators receive and how they can determine over the course of being familiar with the nature of bus movement and passengers getting on and off the bus, whether in fact a bus passenger requires extra time and attention to secure.
That's fine. That's evidence about somebody saying something, but I'm not understanding why this has anything to do with expertise. Imagine that the bus driver put his hands in front of his eyes and started driving. Would you say that it requires an expert to say that bus drivers shouldn't put their hands over their eyes?
No, because that's the type of violation of, for instance, a District of Columbia traffic regulation that would not require expert testimony. If the bus operator failed to pay full time and attention, that's a question of fact that I don't think.
Why can't a normal juror, in their own normal experience, know that you should look in the back seat, in your car, in your bus, and just make sure before you start that people have a hold on to something? I don't understand that. I do not read the case law as saying that every single thing about buses has to require an expert witness. And I don't think the case law says that.
I think we agree with that, Your Honor. In our brief, we address the fact that starting smoothly and gradually is not the type of requirement that requires expert testimony.
And that's what Judge Friedman said about that, right?
Yes.
Although he did say it was superseded by the extraordinary force rule.
Correct. Right. And there's a whole line of cases that I know this Court is familiar with, including Boyko and Breithoff, which is Judge Sentell's decision, and Pasmino, that discuss the quality of the evidence that was required in order to establish that the bus operator operated the bus in violation of what we see in the standard jury instruction as in excess of the normal jerks and jolts. And
But Breithoff's a good example. This is a case where the driver started with the person in front of the white line.
Yes.
Right? Was there an expert witness in that case?
I
don't think there was.
I don't believe there was, Your Honor.
And what we said in that case is it's unclear whether the jury could have properly have considered the white line policy conclusively to establish the governing standard. It's enough when augmented by the description of the bus's movement to support the jury's verdict.
Right. And this was a case which challenged whether the bus operator had started smoothly and gradually.
But
which
it also relied on an SOP, don't start before the person's behind the line.
It did. Yeah. And the court questioned whether, it is unclear whether, in Breithoff, the court said, although it is unclear whether the jury could properly have considered the white line policy conclusively.
Now, I think everybody agrees on the conclusively point. That is, even your opponent doesn't think it's conclusive. At least that's what he told me. So I think we can go forward on that theory. It seems to me, I mean, I think the cases are a little confusing on this subject. But I think that we really captured where D.C. law is in this opinion in Johnson versus WMATA, where it describes two kinds of evidence of negligence. One, you can come up with two kinds. One is circumstantial, that is the extraordinary movement line, which you agree can be done without an expert. And the other is direct evidence of negligence. In that case, the driver was turning his head.
Yes.
And I'm not sure why this doesn't fall within that, or why a reasonable jury couldn't have concluded that failing to look behind. I'm not saying that you'll lose, because we do have this causation problem.
Correct.
But I don't understand why not looking in a mirror is something that is so far beyond a juror's technical competence that they can't think that's negligent behavior.
Well, there were a number of alleged violations that the plaintiff below, Ms. Robinson, had claimed that the bus operator had violated. And failing to use the inside mirror was one of at least three that, when considered together, were regulations or violations of internal standards that were not an indication of negligence in and of themselves. And the argument was being made at the trial court level that those SOPs established a standard of care that our bus operator had violated. And based upon a number of cases that in this court and in the D.C. Court of Appeals that said internal guidelines, while aspirational, do not, in and of themselves, there can be evidence of negligence, but they cannot be relied upon themselves to satisfy a case sufficient to go to the jury on negligence. So I think that when looking at all the allegations together and the alleged violations by our operator together, that the only support that the plaintiff had until Dr. Berkowitz was identified was that our standard operating procedures require certain things to be done and that the operator had violated those procedures. Now, the court has, of course, pointed out that had the operator looked in the mirror done that one specific act, he would have seen Ms. Robinson holding on to a handrail, which Dr. Berkowitz never said constituted a situation where a person could be deemed not secure for movement. In this case, it almost is without effect that the operator said he did not recall looking in the mirror to check Ms. Robinson. The whole case on failing to start smoothly and gradually, actually, it's not a failing to start smoothly and gradually. What the evidence was that the bus operator applied his brakes in a way that was aggressive. That particular violation was not proven because there was no evidence sufficient to establish the standards set out in Boyko and a variety of other cases. You have to have something that identifies that movement as violent and abnormal and extraordinary, not simply that it was fast or quick. In Boyko,
can I
there
ask
was,
about that?
Yes.
So in Boyko, the court says we do not require any particular descriptive adjectives, right?
Correct.
It's whether the testimony, in whatever form it is offered, describes movement that is consistent with the proper operation of the bus. And later, they, and in this and other cases, they say the usual operation of buses.
Correct.
So why isn't it enough that she testified that the bus was traveling, quote, faster than normal? Why wasn't that? I take it that the other statements don't necessarily show anything, but that one is an effort to show some comparison to the usual operation of a bus.
Right. But what Boyko and the other cases that follow Boyko say is that you need to have more than that. That while that evidence in and of itself is, it's not that that's irrelevant. It must be supported by something else. And in Boyko, the something else was a passenger inside the bus who testified as to the violent nature of the fall that the passenger had sustained. And in Boyko, there was evidence from a medical provider, the treating physician, that this
where does it hold that the victim's testimony alone can't be enough? Is that the position you're taking?
Yes.
That a victim's statement can't be enough?
Just to say that the bus was moving fast or quick or
faster than normal.
Faster than normal. Yeah. Yes, that's not enough to satisfy the Boyko standard.
What case says that? Or where do you get the faster than normal isn't enough?
Well, in Boyko, the actual words or parts of speech that a witness may employ on the stand are irrelevant to the court's ruling on the motion for judgment NOV, which must be based on the substance of the testimony and not its grammatical form. We're not saying that adjectives and the description by the plaintiff are irrelevant, but there must be more to support that.
Well, the more, according to Boyko, is that it has to be described movement that is not consistent with the usual operation of the bus. It's all Boyko's, is all about Ms. Boyko's testimony. And in that case, the court says, well, she said it was abrupt and violent, and that is not consistent with the normal operation of a bus unless we think abrupt and violent movement is consistent. In this case, we have somebody who is specifically comparing it to the usual operation of a bus.
Well, one of the questions to Ms. Robinson was at trial, how was this different? How was this movement different from any other bus that you had been a passenger on, and her answer in cross-examination was that usually the bus operator waits until I'm seated. However, even if she were to have repeated to me in response to that question that there was an abrupt or faster than normal movement of the bus, I think based upon what the court says you need to show in Boyko and in Breithoff, which also had medical testimony.
Well, I'm not understanding one thing. So suppose that, is your argument that the description she made doesn't do enough? Or is your argument that the fact that she's the one making the description is what's significant? In other words, I mean, suppose she says, it was extraordinary. It was the craziest bus movement I've ever experienced in my life. I've been on a bus 75 years. There's nothing ever like it that I've experienced. It was extraordinary, and it was violent. Does the fact that she, and nobody else testifies about it. She's the only one who does. But what she says clearly surpasses the boycott bar.
It's not.
Does somebody else have to say it too?
There has to be corroborating evidence.
Really? Why? Why? How could that be?
Or when does the D.C. court said that?
Well,
boycott just says the opposite, in fact, I think. It basically says, to the extent that there's a suggestion that other passengers have to chime in on this, we reject that. Which is a different proposition from saying that what she said isn't enough.
Yeah, that's quite a different proposition, but no court has ever said there has to be corroborating evidence of it.
The boycott court said that they hold that the boycott court held, quote, that the combination of appellant's testimony and that of her doctor and the bus driver was sufficient to go to the jury.
All right, they say that's sufficient, but nothing there says it would be insufficient to have only the plaintiff's testimony on that element of negligence.
And there are a number of cases that precede boycott.
Well, boycott itself says, appellee seems to argue that Jones should apply only to the testimony of non-passengers who are not parties to the suit. I guess that's talking about non-passengers. But still, it says, whether this argument is based on some fancy defect in a passenger's vantage point or in the self-evident interest of a party in the outcome of the case is unpersuasive, which just seems to me to be the normal proposition that why can't the verdict be based on the testimony of the person who was directly victimized by the conduct that she's challenging? Now, whether what she says is enough goes to the substantive weight of her testimony, but not to whether she alone can establish evidence from which a jury could find liability.
The cases that precede boycott and talk about what was sufficient, boycott talks about what was sufficient before that court. In Wiggins and in the Fells case, the D.C. Court of Appeals rejected testimony of the plaintiff alone that the bus, quote, started suddenly and threw her to the floor.
But not on the
record. They rejected on the basis that she was the only witness.
Yes.
Or did they reject it? They did?
I thought they rejected it because they're...
Give me that one again.
In Fells, in Wiggins, rather, versus Capital Transit, which is at 122A, second 117, the only witness was the plaintiff who boarded the bus and indicated that the bus started suddenly, and a passenger also said the bus had a little jerk. That was how the passenger described the movement of the bus.
And there's nothing in the case. I have the case in front of me. It says these statements are not themselves sufficient. Doesn't in any way suggest that a victim needs corroboration. Is there any, are you familiar with any area of tort law where a victim's testimony alone can't be trusted? Isn't that left to the credibility of the jury?
Not with respect to the movement as the courts and the jury instruction have established, the movement of the bus, of buses in general.
What if she's the only passenger? Is she out of luck because there's nobody else on the bus?
It depends on a number of things. If she's injured and there's testimony, medical testimony, that indicates that this injury could have happened only in the course of a violent fall or violent movement. But if she just describes the bus's movement as fast or faster than normal.
But yeah, you're conflating two things. You have one argument that says that saying that the bus moved faster than normal just isn't enough, even if 1,000 people say it. You have another argument that says that she's the only one who's saying it's faster than normal, and that's not enough because other people have to say it. And I guess the latter one seems difficult to stomach based on the way that we generally understand juries to work and evidence to be submitted.
Yeah.
The former one goes to whether the description is faster than normal is enough, and whether she says it alone or whether everybody, all 35 people on the bus, say it. And as to that, I guess the question is saying that the movement is faster than normal enough under D.C. law? And on that, the one case that I ran across that might speak to it to some extent is Perry. And I can't.
Yes.
And I thought, didn't Perry have the description unusually fast?
Yes, it did.
And unusually fast was deemed not to be enough.
Yeah.
As I recall.
I believe that Perry held that absent meaningful evidence regarding how significantly the movement of the bus deviated from the norm, such as evidence of the effect on other passengers, the trial court should have entered judgment for the defendant, and that was the holding in Perry.
Yeah, but I thought there was evidence in Perry submitted to the jury that said that the movement was unusually fast, and maybe I'm misremembering.
No, that is correct. That was the term used by the plaintiff, who said that the bus, quote, jerked, and also that it, yes, as Your Honor has indicated, moved unusually fast. But the court held that that was not enough.
Right, and so unusually fast, maybe that's a reason why faster than normal wouldn't be enough.
It's the qualitatively the same type of testimony.
Right. But that's a different proposition. The insufficiency of the statement is a different proposition than saying there has to be more than one person making the statement. Are you actually taking the position that you could not find negligence based on the uncorroborated testimony of a plaintiff if that testimony were in and of itself of a nature that would normally be sufficient to go to the jury?
If the testimony were in the nature of the description...
Don't tell me any ifs. That's a yes or no question. Are you really taking the position that there has to be corroborating evidence of a plaintiff's testimony before it can get to the jury?
No.
You're not taking
that position. That is not the position that we are taking.
You're not taking that position.
That's correct. As a general proposition, that is not the position,
okay,
of course.
No,
Your Honor. What we are saying is that because the nature of this type of travel includes jerks, and as the courts have used these terms, jerks.
We're talking about jolts. Movement, not other people on the bus.
Right.
I'm sorry.
There are any lawyers or other people involved in the news.
That is part of the problem with bus travel.
It's a problem with car travel.
Sometimes, correct.
All right. Do we have any other questions
from
members of the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does Mr. Parsons have any time left? We'll give you another 2 minutes. We gave her extra time as well.
I wanted to address two things. Number one, regarding Dr. Berkowitz's testimony, I think at page 41 of my brief, I quoted a direct some of his testimony. If you look at Appendix 325, 326, and also Appendix 270 to 275, you'll see that he testified, look, here's what goes on in these hearings and what goes on as far as formulating standards. We do the research. Let me just see here at page. There's direct testimony. So where did these, the recommendation was that to avoid falls on a bus, start gradually, stop smoothly, and turn slowly. The court asked him, where do those come from? They come from the National Academy of Science. He says, but that's why WMATA's standard operating procedure, right? But the information in this terminology comes from these studies, again, elsewhere. Now, I also want to point out that there was a standard about requirement for courtesy cards. We know that there were seven people on this bus and that Ms. Robinson was injured and escorted off the bus. The bus operator was supposed to get the names of those witnesses. We don't have corroborating evidence about speed, although we do know from the testimony that did come in that some of the people on the bus said, slow down, just before Ms. Robinson went to the floor.
Did that go into evidence?
It did.
The trial?
That part did come into there was a testimony. The persons on the bus yelled out to the driver, slow down. And
is it clear that they yelled that out before
she fell?
Or yeah.
Before
she fell.
And at the, it occurred within the seven-second period. Remember,
I thought that testimony was that they were telling the bus driver to slow down because she had fallen. In other words, slow down because there's somebody who's hurt back.
I believe not. I wish I could say definitively, but the record is clear that the passengers on the bus were yelling. Finally, the actual wording of the standard operating procedure, check that passengers are secure and prepared for vehicle movement. A person with, I do not think, even if the operator had looked, he could say with certainty that she was secure. She had her back to him. She was standing as people do with her hand on the rail, but that does not carry the strong inference that she was secure for him to make.
And I think this was explored before, but I want to make sure I understand. Are you contending that the fact that her back was to the driver in and of itself establishes that she was not secure?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that she's vulnerable with her back to him. His duty is to make sure that the lady he's looking at.
Does he have to make sure that all passengers don't have their backs turned before he starts every time?
In order to
meet your standard of care, or what you say is the standard of care, does he have to make sure every time that no passenger has a back turn?
No, Your Honor. I would say this. The standard calls for secure and prepared. Looking at somebody with their back to them and getting ready to pull off does not – and first, he never looked, so he didn't know. And we know she wasn't. But second of all, the requirement is secured and prepared. All he would have seen is a lady with her back to him if he was a country.
Holding a rail. Holding a seat back.
And had her hand on a rail, mm-hmm. probably maybe for balance, not because she anticipated a sudden pull away. That's what he's got to ascertain. Thank you.
We'll take the matter under submission, and we'll have a brief recess while the next set of counsel come forward.